She was now blamed for greenlighting such box office dogs as Timeline and Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life. Suddenly, the conventional wisdom was that Lansing was risk-averse, old-fashioned, and out of touch with the trends. But can she really be blamed for thinking that a Michael Crichton bestseller would be promising movie fodder? And where were all the Lara Croft critics when the first Tomb Raider film took in $131 million in box office revenue? Even if the theories of Lansing's shortcomings were plausible, consider how abruptly her demise occurred. Did she become risk-averse and out of touch overnight because Paramount's market share plunged that suddenly? One year, Lansing was flying high. The next, she was a punchline for late-night comedians. Her change of fortune might have been understandable if, like others in Hollywood, she had become depressed over a nasty divorce proceeding, had been charged with embezzlement, or joined a religious cult. That was not the case. And she certainly hadn't sustained any damage to her cerebral cortex. The only evidence of Lansing's newly developed failings that her critics could offer was, in fact, her newly developed failings. In hindsight, it is clear that Lansing was fired because of the industry's misunderstanding of randomness, and not because of her flawed decision-making. Paramount's films for the following year were already in the pipeline when Lansing left the company. So, if we want to know roughly how Lansing would have done in some parallel universe in which she remained in her job, all we need to do is look at the data in the year following her departure. With such films as War of the Worlds and The Longest Yard, Paramount had its best summer in a decade and saw its market share rebound to nearly 10%. This isn't merely ironic. It's again that aspect of randomness called regression toward the mean. A Variety headline on the subject read, "Parting Gifts, Old Regimes, Picks, Fuel, Paramount Rebound." But one can't help but think that had Viacom, Paramount's parent company, had more patience, the headline might have read, "Banner Year Puts Paramount and Lansing's Career Back on Track." Sherry Lansing had good luck at the beginning and bad luck at the end, but it could have been worse. She could have had her bad luck at the beginning. That's what happened to a Columbia Pictures chief named Mark Canton. Described as box office savvy and enthusiastic shortly after he was hired, he was fired after his first few years produced disappointing box office results. Criticized by one unnamed colleague for being incapable of distinguishing the winners from the losers, and by another for being too busy cheerleading, this disgraced man left in the pipeline when he departed such films as Men in Black, $589 million in worldwide box office revenue, Air Force One, $315 million, The Fifth Element, $264 million, Jerry Maguire, $274 million, and Anaconda, $137 million. As Variety put it, Canton's legacy pictures hit, and hit big. Well, that's Hollywood, a town where Michael Ovitz works as Disney president for 15 months and then leaves with a $140 million severance package, and where the studio head David Beagleman was fired by Columbia Pictures for forgery and embezzlement, and then is hired a few years later as CEO of MGM. But as we'll see in the following chapters, the same sort of misjudgments that plague Hollywood also plague people's perceptions in all realms of life. My own epiphany regarding the hidden effects of randomness came in college, when I took a course in probability and began applying its principles to the sports world. That is easy to do because, as in the film business, most accomplishments in sports are easily quantified and the data is readily available. What I discovered was that just as the lessons of persistence, practice, and teamwork that we learn from sports apply equally to all endeavors of life, so do the lessons of randomness. And so I set out to examine a tale of two baseball sluggers, Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle, a tale that bears a lesson for all of us, even those who wouldn't know a baseball from a ping-pong ball. The year was 1961. I was barely of reading age, but I still recall the faces of Maris and his more popular New York Yankees teammate Mantle on the cover of Life magazine. The two baseball players were engaged in an historic race to tie or break Babe Ruth's beloved 1927 record of 60 home runs in 1 year. Those were idealistic times when my teacher would say things like, "We need more heroes like Babe Ruth," or "We never had a crooked president." Because the legend of Babe Ruth was sacred, anyone who might challenge it had better be worthy. Mantle, a courageous perennial slugger who fought on despite bad knees, was the fans' and the press's overwhelming favorite. A good-looking, good-natured fellow, Mantle came across as the kind of all-American boy everyone hoped would set records. Maris, on the other hand, was a gruff private fellow, an underdog who had never hit more than 39 home runs in a year, much less anywhere near 60. He was seen as a nasty sort, someone who didn't give interviews and didn't like kids. They all rooted for Mantle. I liked Maris. As it turned out, Mantle's knees got the best of him, and he made it to only 54 home runs. Maris broke Ruth's record with 61. Over his career, Babe Ruth had hit 50 or more home runs in a season 4 times, and 12 times had hit more than anyone else in the league. Maris never again hit 50 or even 40, and never again led the league. That overall performance fed the resentment. As the years went by, Maris was criticized relentlessly by fans, sports writers, and sometimes other players. Their verdict? He had crumbled under the pressure of being a champion. Said one famous baseball old-timer, "Maris had no right to break Ruth's record." That may have been true, but not for the reason the old-timer thought. Many years later, influenced by that college math course, I would learn to think about Maris's achievement in a new light. To analyze the Ruth-Mantle race, I reread that old Life article and found in it a brief discussion of probability theory and how it could be used to predict the result of the Maris-Mantle race. I decided to make my own mathematical model of home run hitting. Here's how it goes. The result of any particular at-bat, that is, an opportunity for success, depends primarily on the player's ability, of course, but it also depends on the interplay of many other factors. His health, the wind, the sun, or the stadium lights, the quality of the pitches he receives, the game situation, whether he correctly guesses how the pitcher will throw, whether his hand-eye coordination works just perfectly as he takes his swing, whether that brunette he met at the bar kept him up too late, or the chili cheese dog with garlic fries he had for breakfast soured his stomach. If not for all the unpredictable factors, a player would either hit a home run on every at-bat or fail to do so. Instead, for each at-bat, all you can say is that he has a certain probability of hitting a home run and a certain probability of failing to hit one. Over the hundreds of at-bats he has each year, those random factors usually average out and result in some typical home run production that increases as the player becomes more skillful and then eventually decreases owing to the same process that etches wrinkles in his handsome face. But sometimes, the random factors don't average out. How often does that happen? And how large is the aberration? From the player's yearly statistics, you can estimate his probability of hitting a home run at each opportunity, that is, on each trip to the plate. In 1960, the year before his record year, Roger Maris hit one home run for every 14.7 opportunities, about the same as his home run output averaged over his 4 prime years. Let's call this performance Normal Maris. You can model the home run hitting skill of Normal Maris this way. Imagine a coin that comes up heads on average not one time every two tosses, but one time every 14.7. Then flip that coin one time for every trip to the plate and award Maris one home run every time the coin comes up heads. If you want to match, say, Maris's 1961 season, you flip the coin once for every home run opportunity he had that year. By that method, you can generate a whole series of alternative 1961 seasons, in which Maris's skill level matches the home run totals of normal Maris. The results of those mock seasons illustrate the range of accomplishment that normal Maris could have expected in 1961 if his talent had not spiked. That is, given only his normal home run ability plus the effects of pure luck. To have actually performed this experiment, I'd have needed a rather odd coin, a rather strong wrist, and a leave of absence from college. In practice, the mathematics of randomness allowed me to do the analysis employing equations in a computer. In most of my imaginary 1961 seasons, normal Maris's home run output was, not surprisingly, in the range that was normal for Maris. Some mock seasons he hit a few more, some a few less. Only rarely did he hit a lot more or a lot less. How frequently did normal Maris's talent produce Ruthian results? I had expected normal Maris's chances of matching Ruth's record to be roughly equal to Jack Whittaker's when he plopped down an extra dollar as he bought breakfast biscuits at a convenience store a few years back and ended up winning $314 million in his state Powerball lottery. That's what a less talented player's chances would have been. But normal Maris, though not Ruthian, was still far above average at hitting home runs. And so normal Maris's probability of producing a record output by chance was not microscopic. He matched or broke Ruth's record about one time every 32 seasons. That might not sound like good odds, and you probably wouldn't have wanted to bet on either Maris or the year 1961 in particular. But those odds lead to a striking conclusion. To see why, let's now ask a more interesting question. Let's consider all players with the talent of normal Maris and the entire 70-year period from Ruth's record to the start of the steroid era, when, because of players' drug use, home runs became far more common. What are the odds that some player at some time would have matched or broken Ruth's record by chance alone? Is it reasonable to believe that Maris just happened to be the recipient of the lucky aberrant season? History shows that in that period there was about one player every 3 years with both the talent and the opportunities comparable to those of normal Maris in 1961. When you add it all up, that makes the probability that by chance alone one of those players would have matched or broken Ruth's record a little greater than 50%. In other words, over a period of 70 years, a random spike of 60 or more home runs for a player whose production process merits more like 40 home runs is to be expected. A phenomenon something like that occasional loud crackle you hear amid the static in a bad telephone connection. It is also to be expected, of course, that we will deify or vilify, and certainly endlessly analyze, whoever that lucky person turns out to be. We can never know for certain whether Maris was a far better player in 1961 than in any of the other years he played professional baseball, or whether he was merely the beneficiary of good luck. But detailed analyses of baseball and other sports by scientists as eminent as the late Stephen Jay Gould and the Nobel laureate E. M. Purcell show that coin-tossing models like the one I've described match very closely the actual performance of both players and teams, including their hot and cold streaks. When we look at extraordinary accomplishments in sports or elsewhere, we should keep in mind that extraordinary events can happen without extraordinary causes. Random events often look like non-random events, and in interpreting human affairs, we must take care not to confuse the two. Though it has taken many centuries, Scientists have learned to look beyond apparent order and recognize the hidden randomness in both nature and everyday life. In this chapter, I presented a few glimpses of those workings. In the following chapters, I shall consider the central ideas of randomness within their historical context and describe their relevance with the aim of offering a new perspective on our everyday surroundings and hence a better understanding of the connection between this fundamental aspect of nature and our own experience. Chapter 2. The Laws of Truths and Half-Truths. Looking to the sky on a clear moonless night, the human eye can detect thousands of twinkling sources of light. Nestled among those haphazardly scattered stars are patterns. A lion here, a dipper there. The ability to detect patterns can be both a strength and a weakness. Isaac Newton pondered the patterns of falling objects and created a law of universal gravitation. Others have noted a spike in their athletic performance when they are wearing dirty socks and thenceforth have refused to wear clean ones. Among all the patterns of nature, how do we distinguish the meaningful ones? Drawing that distinction is an inherently practical enterprise. And so it might not astonish you to learn that, unlike geometry, which arose as a set of axioms, proofs, and theorems created by a culture of ponderous philosophers, the theory of randomness sprang from minds focused on spells and gambling, figures we might sooner imagine with dice or a potion in hand than a book or a scroll. The theory of randomness is fundamentally a codification of common sense. But it is also a field of subtlety, a field in which great experts have been famously wrong and expert gamblers infamously correct. What it takes to understand randomness and overcome our misconceptions is both experience and a lot of careful thinking. And so we begin our tour with some of the basic laws of probability and the challenges involved in uncovering, understanding, and applying them. One of the classic explorations of people's intuition about those laws was an experiment conducted by the pair who did so much to elucidate our misconceptions, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Feel free to take part and learn something about your own probabilistic intuition. Imagine a woman named Linda, 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. In college, she majored in philosophy. While a student, she was deeply concerned with discrimination and social justice and participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Tversky and Kahneman presented this description to a group of 88 subjects and asked them to rank the following statements on a scale of 1 to 8 according to their probability, with 1 representing the most probable and 8 the least. Here are the results in order from most to least probable. I'll give you each statement and then its rank. Linda is active in the feminist movement, 2.1. Linda is a psychiatric social worker, 3.1. Linda works in a bookstore and takes yoga classes, 3.3. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement, 4.1. Linda is a teacher in an elementary school, 5.2. Linda is a member of the League of Women Voters, 5.4. Linda is a bank teller, 6.2. And finally, Linda is an insurance salesperson, 6.4. At first glance, there may appear to be nothing unusual in these results. The description was, in fact, designed to be representative of an active feminist and unrepresentative of a bank teller or an insurance salesman. But now let's focus on just 3 of the possibilities and their average ranks, listed in order from most to least probable. This is the order in which 85% of the respondents ranked the 3 possibilities. Linda is active in the feminist movement, 2.1. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement, 4.1. And finally,